Hello, everyone. Welcome to Fired Up, the podcast for marketers working in early and late stage startups. I'm Morgan McClintic, the CEO of startup marketing agency Firebrand. We've launched this podcast to interview the best in the business, but I'm not going to do it alone. So please meet my co-hosts.
I'm Nicole Pytel, Firebrand's VP of Content Marketing.
And I'm Chris Ulbricht, Firebrand's Head of Media Relations.
I'm Ian Lipner, a tech PR and crisis communications veteran.
We'll drop a new episode each week, so there's plenty of fuel for your marketing fire. Get the spark you need to take your startup to a whole new level. Hello, and welcome to another edition of Fired Up. My name is Morgan McClintic, and I am joined today by the queen of content marketing, Nicole Pytel.
Hey, Morgan. Hey, everybody. Great to be here. Very excited about today's conversation.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about some recent stats and research that the Content Marketing Institute has released into B2B tech marketing companies. Before we get into that, I just come back from spring break and I went to Colorado skiing, which was wonderful. But whilst we were there, we also visited the University of Colorado at Boulder, where my son is thinking about going, which was terrific. And we're really in a sort of window now where lots of the universities, is this time of year, where lots of the universities are marketing to him, and I guess to us as parents, and many of our audience can maybe relate to that or remember when they were at that phase. And it's a really interesting dynamic because here you have a highly complex proposition, select high cost selection. It's an infrequent purchase. It needs a lot of information. It's very competitive and it's very sort of success or fail. Like he's only going to go to one and everybody else who's in the race, he can't go to. And so I feel like for startup marketers, there's probably some things that we can learn from that. So maybe we'll just spend a few minutes talking through that.
100%. And not unlike B2B purchases, there is a bit of a buying committee here because it's not just up to Jake. It's up to you and your wife and because you're writing the checks. And so a lot of people are involved in this. So there are some parallels. So yeah, thanks for taking me back in that time machine back to when I was getting this marketing.
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, you choose five and you just give them one and that's that. So this has been a really interesting, but I've never done this before. But early on in the selection process, you as the student are sort of selling yourself to the universities, right? You've got to be made that vital offer. But then it sort of flips and they're in sales mode because they've made you the offer and they're now competing with however many other universities who have also made offers. And so it becomes quite sort of frantic on their part. They obviously have a lot of information about the students, the prospects, right? They know where they live, they know their number, like they know a lot of information about you in the same way as a startup can build a lot of information about their target prospects. They're really doing sort of multi-channel marketing, right? So how can they reach us? They definitely email all the time. They do a lot of webinars, right? Here, come and understand how our financing process is. Come and look inside. He's applying for business, a business school. Let's go through all the different courses. So they're trying to unpack. Here's our athletics program that, you know, you're invited to come to webinars. They're trying to educate the buyer about that and opt in and get some sort of signal from us. Did we open those emails? Did we sign up to that webinar? They're also doing in-person events, right? I've been to several, but we went to the one at Boulder and, you know, that's open doors and it's very high involvement from the faculty and from a bunch of the students there. They're trying to sort of show off their campus to the best of their ability. And it's the same with a lot of startups. So trying to get people to come and sign up and register, that's a good signal of engagement for them. And the events have to go well. So, you know, you have to have a good experience. And that experience goes from the registration, the food, to the court, to the actual content of the various sessions that they're presenting. And, you know, they should be good at this. But I would say that Boulder, for example, they only have one event, right? So, or they have 10,000 kids in every cohort that come. half of the kids might turn up at this. So this is like 5,000 families all trying to channel it. So yeah, my first impression, it's a brilliant campus, but it took an hour to register. So you're like, okay, it's cold and I'm standing outside for an hour. And then everybody, 5,000 families are going for lunch at the same time. So the little details are important. And, you know, you're like, okay, this isn't reflective. Maybe they needed to do more of those events and break it out than sort of have 5,000 people congregate in one time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes them look very popular, but the experience, you're out in the cold, you're waiting for food. Yeah, it's a little bit like cattle herding. Sorry, Boulder. It's interesting, and it's almost like an ABM play in some ways. You know, like they've got these targets. They know which kids they want to go after. They know who's smart. And this is their target account list, and they're trying to make the best impression possible. So yeah, there are a ton of parallels here, which is very funny. And I would not have made that correlation had you not just gone on spring break.
The other thing is that the differentiation between these institutions, they're all really good. They all have amazing campuses. They have very bright professors. They have interesting courses. I would love to go to any of these. I mean, you go to each one, but you feel like when you're working within a company that you're very different for all these specific ways, but all the companies are different in the same way. Like all these universities, they really feel very similar. And so that really says the importance of brand is critical. Like, what do you stand for? And they're all using the same kind of channels and saying the same kind of thing. And I would say just sort of two of them stood out to me the most. One of them is a university called Marquette. And now this is based in Milwaukee. It's a very good university, but a lot of people have not been to Milwaukee.
It's not a travel destination. No.
You've never been. We might be great for you, but I got to get you here. So how do they get you here? They actually offered to fly us in there and him and a parent to come and see the campus because they've recognized, look, we could be a great place, but if nobody comes, we don't get a chance to show off our campus and we're not on the usual list of places that people will go to Boston or DC or LA or wherever to visit universities. Milwaukee might not be on that list. So they did something really unusual, like a purple cow thing to say, hey, we're going to fly people in, which I think is really good. And they also sent him something like a fist. Everyone's sending these postcards, but they sent him like this sort of salted pretzel. Apparently they're big on pretzels. So in arrives this package, kids love food. This is great. I don't know whether he's going to go there, but their marketing has been a little bit unusual. Nobody else sent him food. Nobody else offered to fly us in. They're trying to overcome their objection to sale through this particular tactic.
I love that. And I feel like I've been a little bit with you guys on this journey because it's been going and going and going. But that's really cool. And considering all the places that you've been to, that does stand out. I mean, I would have expected some cheese or cheese curds instead of the pretzel, but it stands out regardless.
It did. And the other one on brand, we went up to see the University of Oregon. Actually, they have a great comms program. I've had a bunch of their people go Ducks. In the past, they're very good. But one thing that you really notice there, that's based in Eugene, which is a small town in Oregon, it's very branded when you get there. Like, they have a logo. It's an O. There's a history behind the logo. They explain the history behind that. You're sitting in a room with yellow and green, which are their brand colors. It is the most branded of all the universities. There's a huge O in the middle of the campus on one of, I think it's the business center that they put up. Actually, you see people walking around with a duck. They have this mascot that is a duck. It's very branded, but it's sort of slick and modern. And I think of all of the ones that I have seen, that one, they really sort of leaned into it. And any startup would be sort of proud to have that kind of level of branding and the consistency across all the sort of touch points, the emails. As soon as you get off the airport, their brand is everywhere.
And that's how it should be. And on the branding podcast episodes we've done, we've talked about that. Like, it is how you sell yourself to the world. It's got to be consistent. It's got to be memorable. So kudos to Oregon.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is a market that most of us are not in for most of the time. But when you're in it, it's defined and they have to surround sound you with email and events and direct mail and all the different things that they, I don't know whether they're doing paid media to the kids too. They're certainly not to me. I think there might be some sort of privacy things around that, but it's a success or fail. I think there's a lot of analogies and sort of making sure that you stand out with your brand, with the types of things that you do is a lesson that we could all learn.
And a long sales cycle to boot, because you're applying, you know, a year in advance, a year and a half in advance, like they've got to keep themselves top of mind for a while. So lots and lots of parallels.
And good luck to everybody who's going through that. Now, I want to spend most of the time here talking about some research, which was recently released by the Content Marketing Institute. And we'll post the link in the show notes, but every year they do a great big survey of content marketers. And they recently released a sort of cut of that for tech companies. Companies, and it's 272 in the sample size, companies of all sizes, down from like 10 person startups up to 1,000 person companies, a pretty even split across that. And I thought what we could do is just go through some of their findings and think about, does that resonate with us, and sort of unpack it a little bit. This is a post actually based on a post by Robert Rose, who's a big content marketing guy. He's written a book. I've got his book around here somewhere, and you can listen to his, they have a podcast.
Oh yeah. He puts out great content. Yeah. They all do over there, but especially him. He's great.
Yeah. Content Marketing Strategy, Robert Rose. That's his book. Let's just sort of dive into this a little bit. Now, one of the first findings that they have is that, look, they start with AI. 79% of technology marketers use generative AI technology. And here's how they use them and see if this resonates. Like more than half use it to brainstorm new ideas. They also, 48% use it to write drafts. 43% to look at headlines and look at keywords. We just published a great blog post. Shout out to Armin. But they also use it, you know, for outlines, a little bit for proofreading, 19% for proofreading. I really like AI for proofreading. Grammarly is, I mean, that thing does an amazing job. But only 10% are using them for graphics, a little bit for video, 7% for video, and 7% for audio. So mainly brainstorming ideas. What do you think about that?
I think it sounds like they've been reading our Firebrand Labs reports, because that's a lot of the same conclusions that we've come to. I'm not surprised that a ton of them are using AI. Of course they are. Of course, they're going to be the earliest adopters of AI. But I think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad they're not using it for the things that people are doing to try and take shortcuts. You know, like you're not going to write your next ebook in ChatGPT. I wouldn't even write my next blog post in ChatGPT, but I may use it to brainstorm some ideas. I may use it to come up with some post titles or some email subject lines. Like you said, Armand did a fantastic look at using it for keyword research. So there's a lot of things that can be done. And so I'm not surprised they're using it, and I'm thrilled they're using it in the right way. Ways that save them time, but don't cut corners and sacrifice quality at the same time.
I will say an interesting one here is that 88% are using the free tool, the free ChatGPT tool, not the paid team subscription or what have you. This was back in July of last year, I think. So even though this data has only been released recently, so that might have changed. They've got more sort of paid subscriptions now, but the free version, the content that you upload into that could be absorbed into the training model. And so I do have slight sort of concerns about some of the free ones there, just from a privacy and confidentiality perspective.
100%. And my guess is tech companies do too. We see that with our clients all the time. You know, they're cybersecurity companies, or they're in the business of LLM security. So that should absolutely be top of mind for tech companies. So yeah, it's kind of surprising a lot of them are using the free version. Maybe back then they were dipping their toes in the water, and They've since figured out, you know, a go-to tool for them.
Related to this is that 63% of them don't have an AI policy. Only 26% say they do have one. And so as an agency, it's important for us to have a policy. And I want to talk about ours in a moment. But having some kind of policy, I think, is important as a brand, even just as a marketing team, so that you all have the same expectations. And we'll link ours, but, you know, and anyone is welcome to copy our one or use it as the basis to develop their own. we really sort of have five pillars to our AI policy. So I just want to talk about that. Number one is all the work is being directed by a human, a specific person, and they are ultimately responsible for whatever the output of their work product is. The AI tool is just a tool, is just an assistant. Everything is going to be reviewed for accuracy and authenticity by that person, even though they may have used an AI tool to kind of build the outline or to do the research. They have to fact check that to make sure that it's their work ultimately.
100%. Contrary to Elon Musk, it has not taken our jobs yet. There are still humans running these things. It's not just the robots running wild.
Right. The second one, I think, particularly important in the kind of line of work that we do is confidentiality, right? We have to be aware that the material that we upload could be absorbed into the model. You are sort of sharing it with a third party, and you don't want it then to, that information to then appear in the results. You know, it could be data, it could be confidential information, it could be anything, right? There are some measures that you can take that does include the paid subscription, just making sure that your team, that you and your team know how the data that you're entering it in is going to be used. I think that's vital.
Absolutely. Yeah. Our clients would probably be not real happy if we didn't have that in there. So yeah, 100%, that's important.
And then the third one is disclosure. Like if you're going to use AI tools, you've got to say that you're using them, and hence that's the policy, right? I think part of this is not to claim work that's done by an AI as having been done by a human, right? Like, that feels wrong. But practically, we are very open about, like, we record the meetings that we have and transcribe them because that speeds up the process, so we can spend more time doing the work and executing and less on the administration. And we've got an accurate recording of all the decisions that we made. We're very transparent about that. And so I think whoever you're working with, even within your team, you've got to make sure that people are clear. How did this work get done? Like, is this done by a computer? Is this done by a human or not? Number four is we're going to be working on, we could talk about this about practices. We're going to make sure that we use best practices. So that's sort of reading and understanding how people are using these tools. You'll remember there was a lot of focus on, hey, prompt engineering and, you know, great lists of prompts. And those are still important, but I think the tools are becoming better than that. But also sort of our responsibility to share that information. And so we launched the Firebrand Labs, and we publish a bunch of reports on how to do things specific, like it might be SEO research, it might be writing headlines, it could be, you know, graphical development, what we found and how we use these tools. And so we use our blog to sort of contribute to the sort of general thinking there. And I think that clients should rely on us to be using best practice.
And I remember when Firebrand Labs came to be, and it was like, okay, we want to use these tools. We want to know the best practices, but we also want to help other people and kind of speed up their learning curve of like, what can you do with it? What can't you do with it? So I think it's really important if you have that knowledge and you're in a position to share it, and we're fortunate enough to be in that position, you absolutely should share it.
And the last one is sort of ethical use. So, you know, making our sort of best efforts to sort of understand, correct, avoid any bias or errors. And, you know, this is obviously tricky. We can't see the biases within it. Obviously, you saw Gemini recently having sort of pictures of racially diverse founding fathers trying to overcorrect on some of its biases. That it's difficult for us to always sort of see that when you're using these tools, but trying to make sure that you're using them in an appropriate way, you know, and we're not sort of deliberately deep faking people to try and pretend and putting that out, right, and pretend that it's something that it's not. So clearly, I don't think it's a controversial one, but I do think it's a constant thing to be vigilant on. So to recap, the five things that we've got is human oversight. You're hiring a team and they're responsible for the work. They're using this as a tool. Confidentiality, don't share anything that you don't want absorbed in the model, or make sure that you're taking precautions to prevent that. Disclosure, what tools are you using and how are you using them? I think your team should have an expectation around that. Making sure that we're using best practice when we're using it internally and we're doing training, but also sort of sharing those best practices, and then just sort of ethical use of it to do it for good and making sure that you're avoiding any bias. So anyway, that's our policy. I'm sure that there could be, you know, we look at this and we can enhance it. There can be other elements that we could have, but it's up on our site if anybody wants to copy it for their agency or for their team, just internally or to review, because the data says here 63% of organizations don't have a policy, but I think we could probably all agree super important.
You need one. Take ours. It's fine.
The next finding here is a little bit about team structure and, you know, how does the work sort of get done? And 54% of them have a sort of centralized team, but only 1% of companies outsource their content marketing.
That's very interesting to me. And I know that's not true at the startup level, because oftentimes they either have a content team of one, or they have a content team of none. They have a head of marketing that's trying to, you know, juggle everything, the content, the demand gen, the PR, the everything. So that number really surprised me. But I guess if you're a bigger tech company, you want to bring that in-house. I've always said when we lose a client because they've been able to grow and expand and build their own internal team, that's almost like graduating. They've graduated from Firebrand. And that's, you know, that's great. That means we've done our job to give them that runway. But that number was surprising to me.
Yeah. And maybe they mean, look, fully outsourcing all of your content marketing strategy, creation, analytics, et cetera. And, you know, I would expect that to be a vanishingly small number to wholly outsource this as a function. But elements of content creation, I mean, I think it's way, way higher than that. It's right up there as the vast majority. They also said, though, like 33% had team members resign, 28% had layoffs, 51% had new team members who were sort of joining the team, but still sort of, you know, onboarding and getting up to speed, painting a picture really of a content team in flux, right? You know, people are leaving, they've got laid off, there's other people are coming in. There are going to be gaps in that process. That resonated with me because that feels exactly the kind of thing that we see a lot.
Absolutely. And not just in tech content, but tech overall, it's been very volatile lately. You know, it just has been. People are coming, people are going. I think content, sometimes there's a little bit of a stigma where people think, oh, well, I can write blog posts or I can write emails. And they've never, the last thing they wrote was a book report in high school, you know, and they think they could just do it, or Bob in accounting can take over the blog, you know, on a Friday afternoon in his spare time. So I think content tends to get a little bit of a bad rap because people think they can do it. So that doesn't really surprise me if, you know, unfortunately folks are getting laid off or switching around. Like it doesn't totally surprise me considering what's going on in the world and then how people tend to perceive content.
Right. And it might be undervalued. And I think also people would like to move around, right? You know, you want to keep your skills sharp. You know, you can sort of burn out on a particular topic. The people with deep domain expertise around a particular subject are in hot demand, right?
Yes.
So they get poached by other companies because, you know, there are only a certain number of people who can write about database development. There's, you know, a handful. And so those people could easily move from company to company. So there is probably quite a lot of flux in the content marketing team. And so if you feel that, then I, you know, certainly not alone according to this stat.
Definitely not alone, which is why the non-freelancing or outsourcing stat kind of befuddled me, because you've still got all of these channels you've got to fill. And if your team is in flux, who's doing the work? So yeah, those two are interesting right next to each other. Interesting dichotomy there.
And unsurprisingly, there has been a big focus on return to work. I think a lot in a lot of companies in tech have done that, having gone heavily remote. But the content teams, they're not finding remote work a challenge at all. Only 21% said that remote work was a challenge. That makes perfect sense to me, because a lot of the content marketing team are individual contributors. A lot of it just requires focus to get that work done. The tools are already in place.
It does. You know, for content especially, and full disclosure, I am on the East Coast. Most of the Firebrand team is on the West Coast. And the amount of writing I get done between 9 a.m. Eastern and noon when you guys all log on is amazing.
Yes.
Some of my best content ideas come between 9 and noon. So that's what I'm doing while y'all are sleeping.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And you've been remote for a number of years, and it's obviously a solved problem. But talking about problems, 61% of technology marketers say that creating the right content for their audience is a challenge. They also say differentiating that content, 58% say differentiating that content is a challenge. Creating content consistently, 49%. Creating quality content, 43%. So making enough good quality SEO optimized content is a problem.
It is a problem. That does not surprise me at all. And I think, you know, in other episodes that we've had on Fired Up, we've had some great folks on here, you know, explaining about persona development and messaging and brand identity. And I feel like, especially at the startup level, it's a small team. Everybody mm-hmm. just kind of gets what we do and what we sell and who we sell it to. And they tend to skip over the, who are our personas? What are they struggling with? What do they need? What are some of their objections we need to overcome? And then trying to create, you know, this ever flowing content stream is so hard, especially for a small team, which is why I always tell people, you know, don't start huge. Don't start with 3 blog posts a week. Start with something you can manage and build up. If you can only do a blog post once a week or every other week and a once a month email, or maybe, you know, a general nurture that you could build once and kind of set and forget until it's time to analyze, like do that instead of the struggle, because eventually you're going to start to put out stuff that either is redundant or isn't as high quality as it should be or isn't differentiated enough. And if you don't have a fantastic understanding of your personas and what makes them tick, it's not going to resonate.
Here's another challenge. 44% say that they struggle to get access to a subject matter expert to actually sort of source the content. And then at the same number, 44% struggle to kind of get approval on that content. Now, that is definitely a problem. And I'm going to guess that the remainder of you are very lucky or are lying about that, because SMEs, subject matter experts, are in hot demand and can often be a real barrier to content production.
They can, and they don't mean to be. They're just very busy people. And, you know, oftentimes we're asking them, hey, we want to write this white paper. We need to talk to you. Or, hey, we want to do this podcast. We want to bring you on. Or, hey, we're working on an infographic. Can you help us kind of figure out what these steps are? You know, we make a lot of requests on the SMEs, and they're off doing SME things, like doing the important things that are their job. So it's not like they say, I don't want to help with the content. It's just there's only 24 hours in a day. And I think, again, that's where that domain expertise comes in on the content side. I will never replace a SME. But if I say, okay, I understand the basics of what your new solution does and who you're talking to, I get that. And I can talk to the SME about like very nitty gritty, super technical things. And instead of having a 30 or 45 minute conversation, maybe it's just a 15 minute conversation, which makes the SME's life a whole lot easier.
Right. So there, if domain expertise, bringing the lot of domain and bringing to it accelerates the process, being able to research and sort of add all the supporting facts around that can accelerate it. And then you're going to write it. Let's say it's written content. You're going to get it right first time. And that's going to ease the approval, because I find sometimes an SME will do the interview and then it can take a long time for them to approve it because they opened it and they're like, oh, okay, this needs more work than I'm ready to put in. And then it sort of just dies in a Google Doc because they never get to it.
I feel like this is where we've kind of evolved our kickoff process with new mm-hmm. clients, where the kickoff is really discovery on our end. You know, obviously we learn things, you know, in the new business SOW process, but once everybody's signed it on board, that's when we can get into a lot of really important questions that are going to inform a lot of different pieces of content. You know, if you say to me, here's why we win deals, here's why we lose deals, that tells me there's stuff that I need to promote in your content. And there's also objections that I need to overcome in your content, so that marketing's fighting that battle where we can automate, we can scale things. Sales has 24 hours in a day. So we learn a lot, you know, who are your personas? Like, What are your competitors doing that you think is great? What are your competitors doing that you think is maybe not so great? And really taking a deep dive into what they do and how they do it and getting that ball rolling so that it is a much smoother process for the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months that we're going to be working with this team.
Yeah. I think also you tend to find it's a bit of a flywheel that once the process starts to work and a few subject matter experts have a good experience and they see the outputs, you know, then they're more willing to sort of put the time in into it. And you sort of build this culture that this is important and it works and we're all part of the success. That helps. And so at the beginning, you talked about that. You got to build that culture of making content marketing a priority and showing the results. And so I think sort of getting that right first time is important.
Yeah. And I think it goes beyond results in the content marketing world. It goes back to what are the results for the entire business? Because as lovely as it is that people are on average spending 5 minutes reading your blog post, that's a lovely vanity metric. But if I can tell a SME, hey, you know, we're doing a re-engagement campaign. You've got hundreds of leads that have just kind of fallen into a black hole. And here's how we're trying to bring them back in and warm them up. And here's, you know, if we can convert these to an MQL and then the percentage of those that go on to SQL and opportunity, that shows that you're thinking big picture and you're thinking pipeline, you're thinking revenue. You're not just thinking, I have to fill an editorial calendar. So I think that goes a long way too with the SMEs.
Yes, definitely. Now, let's just talk a bit about popular content formats. Not a huge surprise here, but most of them, like 96% say short articles and blog posts, case studies, customer stories, 93% really value those. Videos, we've talked about one of the big trends for this year being video. 90% of the surveyed companies say, hey, well, you know, we're producing more video. I think those were interesting. But one data point was that less than half of these companies are using brochures. And so we see a lot of demand for like one pages and solution briefs and sort of educational, low funnel content that you can use to sort of convert prospects. I don't know whether it's the definition of brochure, like some kind of glossy brochure rather than a sort of an electronic PDF the sales team can mail. Maybe it was that. But it really said that, you know, less than half the companies are using brochures. That seems like a gap.
That's interesting to me. But again, if they only interviewed content marketers, who knows what sales is doing or maybe trying to create on their own. So, I mean, they could be trying to do them themselves. I know, you know, there are folks that want to print out some one pagers and take them to a trade show event. Like I'm sure if you visit a booth at RSA, you're going to see people with takeaway products or takeaway collateral because it's something physical that they're hanging on to and they're going to remember you. So it's an interesting finding. I don't think the one pager is dead though. I'm not going to go that far.
No, I agree. Now, interesting that 34% said that one of the key types of content was live streaming content. A third of companies delivering live streaming content. I was surprised by that. I was really surprised by that.
That is surprising.
Fewer than 10%, I would have said. This feels like a lot, and maybe we're going to see more of it, but live streaming is, if you're not doing it, sounds like a third of other companies are, and maybe it's something you should look at.
I do wonder, though, if this is companies trying to dip their toes into video marketing without the production expense, where you can just kind of do a LinkedIn Live and talk and do your thing, and maybe that's them dipping their baby toe in the water before they commit some budget to video production. Might be my guess.
Yeah, that's a good guess. What's the most effective type of content? 59% of companies say it's case studies, and I think that's spot on.
Makes my heart happy to hear that. Case studies are so, so powerful. That is where you are walking the walk. It's one thing for us to say, we know things, we are great, our product is great, but here's where your customers are saying, No, they really do know things and they really are great and their product really is great and it really did make an impact on our business. It's like the humble brag of content marketing or case studies.
Right. And, you know, just going back to my university talk, most of them all had these student panels. And, you know, these are cherry picked three students who are the best and the brightest. And they all say something fairly similar. But having like 30 or 40 case studies, I just spoke to a startup this morning. We've got 30 or 40 case studies. Then you're really getting it done in volume. And, you know, that stands out an awful lot. And you sort of hears that sort of skepticism of, you know, because we can all wheel out a couple of reference sites.
Yeah. And I love it when clients have on their website, you know, a filter for their case studies. If you can filter by use case or by industry or something like that, because that's how you really dig through, say, the 30 or 40 and find maybe the two or three that are for me.
Yeah.
And that's really where the rubber is going to meet the road.
Right. Combine it with video, those video case studies, you're really onto a hot area. We're seeing quite a lot of demand on that side right now. Now, in terms of distribution, so that's content formats, distribution channels. Look, you know, no surprise, blogs, social media platforms, webinars, newsletters, email, in-person events, digital events. Those are all the most popular. So you're probably doing those, right? And if you are, so is everybody else. Right down at the bottom, direct mail, 19% of companies, only 9% are doing direct, which I'm assuming is physical mail.
I didn't know it was still a thing. And that might be the bigger companies doing it. Mm-hmm. In my time working with Google Cloud, they did direct mail. And it was very much a one-to-one ABM kind of thing. Like, we are having Google Cloud Next and we want you to come. Or we're having Google Cloud Summit and we're going to send you a lovely box with this really cool invitation because we really want you to be there. And it's cool to look at when it's designed properly. It's a lot of planning. It can be expensive, but if you're doing one-to-one and, you know, the ROI potential is that big, you know, if we get this one account that pays for the direct mail 20 times over, then try it.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity here, right? If only 9%, 19% of companies are doing it, maybe, you know, you should zig whilst the others are zagging. It's getting a lot easier. There are companies like Lob, PostGrid, who can easily sort of upload and check your addresses and send mails out. You know, it's on demand. Sendoso that does all those lovely gifts. So there are companies that are sort of automating that to make it easier. And I know we've all gone home and it's hard to work, you know, find people's individual addresses. Maybe there's a way to kind of, hey, we're going to give you a gift or send you a t-shirt or what have you, to kind of get people to release that so that you can start doing some more direct mail. There's an opportunity in there. Same with print magazines. Here it says 12% of companies are doing print magazines. Big lift, but if you're producing the content, could be something worth looking into. Those are the channels. The webinars, 56%, people say, in-person events, 53%. They're paying to promote this content, right? Organically, we hope that, you know, people will find our content. We've SEO optimized it, but 77% of companies are using some kind of social media advertising, 71% use sponsorship, 70% use search engine marketing, pay-per-click, display advertising, 66%. So look, it's a paid to kind of reach kind of world. And so everyone is doing that. So reserve some of your budget, and we'll come on to talk about budget, for the promotion of the content in a paid sense.
This is not Field of Dreams. If you publish it, they will not necessarily come, especially, you know, LinkedIn used to be great organically and they have since very much switched to just pay for play. And it is what it is. And SEO is phenomenal, but why not do both? Why choose between cake and pie? Serve both cake and pie.
Oh, yes. Now you're talking. Speaking of LinkedIn, in terms of social channels, I don't think it'll come in as any surprise. 92% of those surveyed said that LinkedIn delivers the best value. And we've really seen that. And I think probably emphasized by 34% that they've said that they've de-emphasized their investment in X, formerly Twitter, over the last year.
Not a surprise.
Not a surprise there. But only 1% said that TikTok was their best performing social channel. But I think a lot more are sort of signing up and starting to sort of experiment that with that. I'd be very surprised in a B2B sense if TikTok rapidly rose to the top of that. But it was one of our predictions, or my predictions, I think, that we were going to see more TikTok marketing from startups over the next year. So I'm drawing a little bit of confidence from that. Let's see. Let's talk about scaling the content just before we, and we'll talk about spend before we wrap. So look, you've got to build your content, then you've got to kind of get, you need more of it. We just talked about sort of developing enough content for your audience is a big challenge. And one of the biggest challenges of scaling content is just sort of 49% say that they struggle with sort of communications across silos within their business. It could be marketing and sales, could be different BUs, depending on how you're structured. So breaking that down or finding ways to sort of share content across different units so that you're working in a sort of collaborative way, I think is really important.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people overlook internal marketing. I mean, especially if you're at a bigger company or something that is very siloed by BU, or sales is very much over here and marketing is very much over there. Go for that internal activation, you know, do a little internal newsletter, you know, something like that. Get your content out to the people that you're working with, not just the people that you're trying to get into pipeline. Because if they see, oh, you know what? I had no idea that you published that. That's like really helpful. Like I've got a prospect that like would eat this up. Go for the internal activation, 100%.
And that could be if you're a consultant working with a large like Workday, ServiceNow, even HubSpot, right? Selling to those reps, getting in front of those reps. That's, you know, you've got to sell to the end customer, but in front of those reps, those guys are also an important channel. So maybe there's a newsletter for them and thinking about them as a little ABM program around them. Really important. 49% of companies struggle with content repurposing. What is content repurposing and why is that hard?
I don't know why it's so hard, because it's actually quite easy. I always like to tell people that content marketing is a process. It's not a project. Mm-hmm. If I'm writing a white paper, that's a project. But if I take that white paper and I write some blog posts based on, you know, a certain hook from it that point to that white paper at the end, if I do maybe, you know, a minute and a half little video of kind of some of the key thought leadershipy points in that white paper, that's something else. You know, if I pull a case study from somebody who used the same technique, something like that, there's a ton of different ways to repurpose content when you start with one asset. So it's a lot easier than I think people think it is. When you start, you go, I have this one giant asset. How can I break it apart and slice and dice it? It's not as hard as it seems. So go repurpose. It's not that hard. I promise.
Right. And I think that there's a sort of premise that I already wrote this blog post or this ebook, or we already did a video on that, and that you sort of assume that your audience have seen it. They probably haven't. And if they have, they might forgive you or skip over that one, right? We as marketers, we've got to keep hitting that message over and over and over again until we're thoroughly bored of saying it. And at only that point will your audience start to kind of go, oh yeah, okay, I got that. And so don't be afraid to just wring as much value out of that survey data, that interview with the CEO to get the thought leadership stuff. You can really break that down a lot and reuse a lot of it. And I doubt that most of your audience will have seen it and got bored of it. People's tolerance is a lot more, and they probably have ignored it.
Well, and as much as we would like to think that our audience is hanging with bated breath, waiting for every new word of ours to come out, like, they're not. They have jobs. They have lives. They're busy. So just because you may have tackled this topic once before, find another hook for it, or find something newsworthy that's happened that puts a slightly different spin on it. Go for it.
Link to this, like 49% struggle with content repurposing. And I think you just got to dive in and do that. 31% have no structured sort of content production process at all, right? And so those things might be related, but you've got to have a process, right?
You've got to have a process. If you just say, all right, we want to do a blog post every week and we want to do a lead gen magnet every quarter, like those will not do themselves. They will not create their own work back plans. They will not create their own brainstorming sessions. You've got to have a process that is repeatable and scalable when you get more folks in the organization.
Right. And honestly, I think that's why a lot of startups, you know, use agencies and partners who are focused on, who clearly have a process and who are going to be focused on driving that process so that it happens. Because if it's part of somebody else's job, it can easily get derailed. And then, you know, you're without the asset for that quarter. And that sort of slows down a lot of the rest of the marketing programs that you planned to run because there's no content to fuel it. The last section here is a little bit about spend, and 18% of the companies, of these 272 companies, said they spend a quarter of their marketing budget on content marketing. What's your take on that?
Wow, that's great, because content is the full funnel experience. It is how you communicate with the world. If you don't have that full funnel content journey, you're going to have a really, really hard time converting people because you could have great top of funnel content. And then it's like, okay, well, now what do I do? There's no case studies. There's no gated assets. There's nothing for a net new lead to convert on, or there's nothing at the bottom of the funnel to get them over the finish line to convince them to talk to sales. So great that you're spending your budget on content because it's such a vital part of how your business runs, because that's how you're sharing it with the world. All those great products and services that you're putting out, you need content for people to even know they exist.
That's right. And then a further 37% are investing between 10 and 25% of their marketing budget. So if you sort of add those two together, 55% of the startups here or the companies here are spending between 10 and 25% of their marketing budget on content marketing. If you're at the top end of that, you're sort of probably a bit more mature in terms of your function. If you're at the bottom end of that, you probably have got room to grow. If you're outside of that, below the 10%, most of your competitors are spending more on it. So be aware that this really, as I said, is a fuel for a lot of your marketing, and they are going to have more jet fuel than you are.
They are. And that doesn't just affect pipeline. That help, you know, that affects investments. You've got to be out there. You've got to have your thought leadership. You've got to have your business impact. You've got to have stuff to get them over the finish line. You can't function in the world today without all of those things.
This research was done by the Content Marketing Institute. They did a very large survey. There's more data on their website. We'll share the links to the full survey. But very grateful to them for collecting and sharing this and giving us a chance to sort of walk through some of our take and some of what we're seeing amongst our clients and prospects at the moment. So today we've talked a bit about universities and how they market themselves, the importance of brand, the importance of differentiation, the importance of trying to have an integrated program to try and really sort of pierce through. And then we've broken down how other tech companies are investing in their content marketing, what types, which channels, the problems that they face, the amount of budget that they're allocating to this. So, Nicole, thanks for taking the time to sort of go through that. And I hope for everyone that was useful for you. I certainly learned a lot sort of combing through this data. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Morgan. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Nicole. Talk soon.
Well, that about wraps it up for today. But before we close, we did want to offer all of our Fired Up friends a chance to grab a mega pack of all of our ebooks and guides. That's our guide to content marketing. That's our startup guide to paid media using Google Ads. It's our guide to attribution. You can get all of those, over 100 pages of goodness, at firebrand.marketing/fired-up freebies. That's freebies with an S. And we hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, please give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts, or drop us a note at firebrand.marketing. And as ever, the details of how to get in touch with our guest today can be found in the show notes. Thank you for listening. And until next week, get out there and crush your marketing goals.